From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The U.S. and Russia, Iran, and nuclear weapons. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. While Hillary Clinton's in Moscow, Vladimir Putin's in Beijing, and other Russian leaders are throwing cold water again on possible sanctions against Iran. Also on Clinton's agenda, renewing the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, which expires in December, a major goal of President Obama. Has he really been able to reset relations with Russia after all? Even if the Cold War rivals agree to reduce their nuclear weapons, will Congress go along? On Reporter's Notebook later on, despite wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, military recruiting is setting historic records. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. Hillary Clinton's in Moscow to talk about Iran's nuclear program and the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, not to mention Afghanistan. We'll hear about diplomacy, war, and nuclear weapons. On Reporter's Notebook, more young Americans than ever before are volunteering to serve in the Army, the Marines, and the National Guard, as the economy left them without any alternatives. First, this news update, some economic news. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose above 10,000, at least briefly today. A year after taxpayers bailed out the banks, J.P. Morgan Chase is making big money again. And today's Wall Street Journal says banks and securities firms are about to pay employees $140 billion in bonuses. That's a record high. Peter Cohen is a management consultant and venture capitalist in Massachusetts, where he teaches at Babson College. His most recent book is You Can't Order Change, Lessons from the Turnaround at Boeing. Peter Cohen, welcome as always.
Thank you, Warren.
Let's take, first of all, the Dow going up around to 10,000, first time that's happened in 7 months. How important is it?
I think it's psychologically important. I think it might make people aware of the fact that the stock market has gone up something like 45% since its low in March, and if they do happen to have any extra money, they might start to think about whether they should be participating in this rally or whether the rally is over and, you know, they're just selling into and buying into a top.
Well, that's for those people that have the money to invest. Now, here's J.P. Morgan Chase making $3.6 billion a year after the bailout. And we're hearing $140 billion in bonuses are about to be passed out. Should Americans be relieved or outraged?
A little bit of both. You know, basically, to revive the idea that John Edwards had about the two Americas, you've got the 0.01% of Americans who are going to make record bonuses this year, but they wouldn't have been even in business right now. They'd be on the street right now if it weren't for the $23.7 trillion in bailouts that came from basically the government, and that includes the taxpayers, and that includes 15.1 million people who were thrown out of work because of the financial crisis.
So why is it, then, that the Pazar can't put any controls on this and the industry, the Wall Street finance industry, just goes ahead and hands out these bonuses, even though there's this extraordinary discrepancy between those people and everybody else?
Two reasons. First of all, many of the banks that are making these billions of dollars of profits have paid back their TARP money, like J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs, so they're theoretically not subject to the whims of the comp cop. But you know, the other thing is that these banks pay $5 billion over the last decade to Washington, both in the form of lobbyist fees and in campaign contributions. So they really get the best government money can buy.
So there really is, then, a political aspect to all of this. It's not just a matter of the economy.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, the Clinton, Bush, and now Obama, you have a Treasury Secretary who is very well represented by Wall Street and very well protected by Wall Street.
So where's all the money coming from to pay the bonuses?
Mostly from all the debt that's been issued to bail out the banks. J.P. Morgan made most of its money by issuing debt. And as I mentioned before, $23.7 trillion in debt has been issued in one form or another to bail out the catastrophe that happened last year. So they're basically still getting bailout money.
Well, what about what's referred to as the real economy?
The real economy is doing terribly. You know, you have a 70% of gross domestic product growth. It comes from consumer spending. And when you have 15.1 million people unemployed, they're not going to be able to increase their spending to boost that real economy. And so what that does is creates this sort of unpleasant, vicious downward cycle where companies have too many people sitting around doing nothing on the factory floor, so they have to lay them off, which means you have more unemployed, which means less demand, and again, too much excess capacity. So this sort of downward cycle continues in the real economy.
Why isn't it that all of this money in the financial sector doesn't help the real economy and to get more and more companies back on their feet? There doesn't seem to be a lot of lending.
There's a lot of trading. That's how, for instance, Goldman Sachs is making a lot of money using $52 billion in federal government subsidized debt to trade and make what will ultimately be enough money to pay them $23 billion in bonuses this year. So they're basically trading for their own account. They're not lending. If you look at J.P. Morgan has big charge-offs and loan problems in the consumer and business lending part of its business. So it's not making money in the part of banking that has to do with Main Street. They're just making money on the Wall Street side of it.
So this is a classic case of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing is you've got sort of a reverse Robin Hood thing going on here where the poor are actually, through their taxes, keeping Wall Street in business. Without that money, without that $23.7 trillion, Wall Street would not exist in any form at all right now.
Do you get any sense that Wall Street or the Congress or the Secretary of the Treasury feels any populist anger at this point?
I think that they feel populist anger, but I think that more strongly they feel the power of that $5 billion in money that has gone to Washington in the last year. Even if you look at the staff, this is something I wrote about on Daily Finance today. If you look at the staff on Geithner's staff, you've got one guy by the name of Gene Sperling, who's taken in $2.4 million in the year before he joined. A lot of that was from Goldman Sachs. Or you look at another guy named Lee Sachs, who pulled in $3 million from Wall Street. So, you know, they're very well represented in the Treasurer's office.
Peter Cohen, consultant, venture capitalist, teacher at Babson College near Boston. Many thanks to you, as always.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, Hillary Clinton in Moscow for talks on Iran and nuclear weapons on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. At the United Nations less than a month ago, Russian President Medvedev was asked about Iran developing the capacity to build nuclear weapons. In some cases, he said, sanctions are inevitable. But in Moscow, yesterday, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said sanctions would be counterproductive. At the time, he was standing next to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. James Collins has the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former ambassador to Russia. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
What's happened in the past month? Has Russia not changed its tune with regard to Iran after all? Did it ever change its tune?
Well, I think, first of all, to understand what was done in Moscow, it's important to realize that there was a review of the Iran position. We have had some change in Iran since the meeting in New York. Iran, first of all, was revealed to have a new enrichment facility and at the same time agreed that certain inspections could take place by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, it was that context in which the discussions took place in Moscow. And it seems to me what Mr. Lavrov was saying is, at this time, sanctions would be counterproductive, or talk of them. Secretary Clinton was talking about next steps with Mr. Lavrov, agreed, I think, that we need to keep the pressure on Iran to meet its obligations under the IAEA inspection, and probably had hoped to have more in the way of discussion of sanctions, but Mr. Lavrov was not prepared for those at this time. What I don't think he said is sanctions would never be effective, and it's my understanding that in meeting President Medvedev, Secretary Clinton also heard again that it may be at some point that sanctions are inevitable.
So have relations with Russia then been reset by the Obama administration, as the vice president famously said, or not?
Well, Secretary Clinton said that she thought that good progress toward that end was being made. I would personally say that we have made progress. that we have a long way to go. And some of the issues that were reviewed by Secretary Clinton with her counterpart were part of that process. So she announced that we were making progress on reaching an agreement to follow on the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And both agreed they wanted to complete that process by December. She certainly had a discussion of missile defense, one of the issues that had been most contentious between us, and said, I think she said it was productive, and so did Mr. Lavrov. Discussions, they reviewed in discussions how we were cooperating on Afghanistan, noting that they had made the first flights now, according to the agreement that was announced in July, that was reached between President Medvedev and President Obama. In short, this was a very wide-ranging review of where we are and what needs to be done. On START, for instance, it seems they discussed the issues that remain, and that seems to have to do with the numbers of warheads that will be allowed and the number of delivery vehicles, so-called missiles, really. That issue is still out there. There's the question of what kind of verification will be taking place in the new treaty as opposed to the previous one. These are the issues that are still there. But clearly they discussed them, and they said, at least, that they made progress.
Again, Ambassador James Collins is now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as director of the Russia and Eurasia program. Andrei Piontkovsky is joining us from Moscow today, leading researcher at the Institute for Systems Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences. Mr. Piontkovsky, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Do you think there has been a change in relations between the United States and Russia since the Obama administration took over?
Yes, I think. And the cooperation on Afghanistan is the most striking manifestation of so-called resetting. Only several months ago, Medvedev was very jubilant standing by Kyrgyzian President Bakiyev announcing his plan to close American American Nana's base. And it seems that now people in Kremlin realized that failure of Americans and NATO in Afghanistan would be catastrophic for Russia, because Islamic fundamentalists would move to the north, to the republics of former Central Asia Republic of Soviet Union in the southern underbelly of Russian Federation. So this symbolic first flight of American military transit to Russia during Secretary Clinton's visit was a very convincing and symbolic success story.
So you're suggesting, then, that it would be perhaps even worse for Russia than it would for the United States if Afghanistan became a failed state or were taken over by the Taliban. Is that correct?
Yes. Paradoxically, it's the case. That's why President Putin made a very wise decision in 2001 when he supported American mission in Afghanistan, because at that time, the perspective of Taliban moving into Central Asia Republic, especially after General Massoud assassination, was very, very real. And in some sense, Americans are fighting Russian war there, and I'm very glad that finally people in Kremlin realize it.
The Americans are fighting a Russian war in Afghanistan. Very interesting phrase. We understand that the line with Andrei Piontkovsky in Moscow is not particularly good. We're trying to improve it. In the meantime, let me go back to former Ambassador James Collins. How important is it that Vladimir Putin, whom many people say is really in charge, happens while Hillary Clinton's in Moscow to be in Beijing?
Well, I don't read too much into these kinds of affairs. It seems to me we're dealing with one Russian government, and from our point of view, it's, I think, only safe to assume that neither Mr. Putin nor Mr. Medvedev acts without the knowledge and basic concurrence of the other. There's just no point in getting into this idea that somehow there are two governments at work. So I don't place very much importance on that. I think, you know, it's clear what Mr. Putin was doing in China from the reports, or at least it's, you know, it seems he was discussing things like arrangements for gas deliveries and so forth. And I don't put any particular importance on this. These trips have been scheduled some time in advance. What I think is important is what Secretary Clinton managed to do with her counterpart, who, after all, is the foreign minister.
Mm-hmm.
And that, it seems to me, was to cover a very broad range of issues and reported pretty good success and not a lot of new agreement on issues where we clearly had differences before.
What about the scrapping of the proposed missile shield system in the Czech Republic and Poland? How important do you think that's been in improving relationships between the two countries?
Well, I think what it did was to remove what had become almost the most contentious issue between the two countries from the table and the agenda, and put in its place a new platform here, if you will, on missile defense, which the Russian side has welcomed and says it wishes to discuss in terms of developing cooperation on missile defense broadly for the region. Now, that's the idea of cooperation is not new. It was put forward by then-President Putin back in the Bush administration. But it has not really gone anywhere until I think we resolve the issue of our own approach to missile defense, which the president did when he announced that we were not going to proceed in Poland and Czech Republic. But we're going to proceed in another system that would employ different kinds of technologies. Now, the Russians have said they welcome that. They want to know more about it. What I took away from this meeting was they had a lengthy discussion about what the president's new system will involve as the Russians try to make up their mind about what kind of cooperation can be possible.
We're still making an effort to get back to Andrei Piontkovsky. We have him on a new line now, once again, a leading researcher at the Institute for Systems Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. Mr. Piontkovsky, while you were off the line, Ambassador Collins said that he didn't think there was much importance to give to the fact that President Putin is not in Moscow at the time that the Secretary of State from the United States is visiting there. Now I believe you did hear, with regard to the missile defense system, what he said, that was the most contentious issue between the two countries. Do you agree, and is the new system that's been announced also going to be an irritant as far as Russia's concerned?
Well, I don't think so. The latest remarks of Mr. Lavrov about new philosophy of American ABM system in Europe was rather conciliatory. And by the way, idea of cooperation on global defense was put forward much earlier than in Putin-Bush times. It was put forward for the first time in the early 90s under President Yeltsin and Clinton. And I was one of the supporters of this idea in Russian Federation. So I don't think that it will be a contentious issue for the immediate future. I think the most difficult issue for Russian-American relations now is Iran, of course, because Moscow is in no mood to introduce new sanction in Iran, against Iran. Well, I recommend to address to article of Dmitry Science in July issue of National Interest. criticized the leading Kremlin lobbyist in Washington. And he published a very interesting article in which he frankly described the Kremlin policy in this crisis. He explains the best-case scenario for Kremlin is not stopping Iranian program by sanctions, but the best-case scenario for them is Israeli preventive strike against Iranian nuclear installation, because everybody understands that in retaliatory strike, Iranians would hit Saudi oil platform in Hormuz Strait, and you can imagine the oil price the day after this exchange of strike. $200 for barrels, $300. That's what Kremlin needs for shaping its economy now. And I can confirm Dmitry Sain's assessment from my exchanges of these Kremlin insiders.
Andrei Piontkovsky, once again in Moscow. Ambassador Collins, back to you. What about an Israeli preemptive strike with regard to the Iranian nuclear installations? Is that in the cards?
Well, I certainly have no indication that we would think that anything but a disaster. And I think while we have continually said nothing is off the table, I know of no one in Washington who thinks that would be a positive or a productive development.
Well, there was this article by Dmitry Symes at President of the Nixon Center.
Well, I mean, look, I understand the point of view. I also have to say that I have not heard a responsible Russian official suggest that anything that would lead to a war on their southern frontiers is anything but a high-risk and very dangerous kind of situation. So I'm a bit dubious that while this is all very Machiavellian and I can understand the logic, that this in fact is the kind of policy the Kremlin would hope to see played out. It's a very high-risk, very dangerous situation when you end up with military activity and war with unpredictable consequences going on in your southern frontiers. And it's been my experience that is the one area that the Russian leadership for decades has had no interest in seeing take place.
Okay.
They want common stability.
Ambassador, former Ambassador James Collins, now at the Carnegie Endowment. We've talked about Iran. We've talked about Afghanistan. We'll be back in a moment, continue this conversation, talk about nuclear weapons. On Reporter's Notebook, more young Americans are volunteering for military service than ever before, even though they're almost certain to go to war. We'll talk about that. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. At the United Nations last month, President Obama expressed a sense of urgency about nuclear weapons.
We must stop the spread of nuclear weapons and seek the goal of a world without them. This institution was founded at the dawn of the atomic age, in part because man's capacity to kill had to be contained. For decades, we averted disaster, even under the shadow of a superpower standoff. But today, the threat of proliferation is growing in scope and complexity.
Once again, Secretary of State Clinton is in Moscow. The United States and Russia have in the neighborhood of 96% of all of the nuclear weapons on the surface of the globe. Binoy Kampark is a former Commonwealth scholar at Selwyn College at Cambridge University. He currently lectures on international relations at the RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia. Binoy Kampark, welcome to you.
Yes, thank you very much, Warren. Welcome.
Two things mentioned by the president, stopping the spread of nuclear weapons, non-proliferation, and working toward a world without nuclear weapons, which, of course, involves arms reductions. Where are we on those with regard to the United States and Russia?
Well, when it comes to the process of arms reductions, it reminds me a bit of that old policy which the with Russia and the United States have been pursuing for many years. It's a process of a bit of musical chairs, window dressing, and whatnot. I think when it comes down to it, it's difficult to see that on the one hand they seem to be have some sort of effect, have an appearance of being effective, but on the other hand, what we tend to see is that technologies get reconfigured, and the sides are simply shifting positions slightly. The urge to modernize weaponry and things like that never goes away. So on the one hand, we have the renegotiation of the START Treaty, but in actual fact, it's renegotiating what essentially was already there. We're still not very clear exactly where it's going in terms of reductions. It's very important to realize that if this relationship moves towards reductions, it at least sends a good message to the overall movement to reduce nuclear weapons in the world, because of course Russia and the United States have by far the largest, I think 90% of the world's warheads. So at least the positive assertions by the Obama administrations is a good thing, but in terms of the practice and the substance of it, we still have to see where that goes.
What's the substance of START, the situation with START at the moment? Where does it stand, the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty?
At the moment, it stands for renewal by, it has to be renewed by December, and this is exactly what one of the issues with discussions taking place at the moment. The issues to be, and one of the points of disagreement or lack of clarity between the sides is, for instance, the number of missiles, that's always one of the issues. The position of the United States on this is that they're doing what's called down loading, namely removing warheads from missiles without necessarily cutting the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles and surface launch ballistic missiles. The Russian position tends to be more a case of reducing the warhead limit by actually cutting back intercontinental ballistic missiles themselves. So what you tend to find is a disagreement on the way the technologies are being used. And this has always been the case in these debates. Weapons delivery systems, we can always chat about them till cows come home, if you like, but it just means that the technologies are reconfigured. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're any safer or the particular treaty is going to be that much more effective. So I think it's important to place it in the context of that as important as these talks are, they're perhaps deceptive in so far as how effective they might be for global stability.
What about the argument that non-proliferation is really an impossibility and that the reduction of weapons to zero, consequently, is an impossibility too? What hope is there for stability if those things are true?
Well, you can look at it from the other side and say that stability is the result of these weapons. And I think this is one of the things that perhaps is not a very popular thing in the current climate of optimism towards reductions and towards non-proliferation. One has to remember that the moment the weapons were used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki resulted in the end of World War II, the option, the atomic option, subsequently the nuclear option, came into being. And the moment those weapons were used, the atomic option became, if you like, a critical aspect of a nation's sovereignty. Everyone, essentially, worth their salt on the international stage, wanted that weapon. As a result, we had everything from a capitalist bomb, a Muslim bomb, a communist bomb, a Jewish bomb, and whatnot. So we essentially have all these items that are coming in to play. Unless one can take the sting out of the interest that states have in acquiring such weapons, we will continue to have the proliferation aspect. The second aspect to remember is that some people argue, this is an argument made incidentally by the French Air Force General Pierre Gallois, who actually made an argument that no state with atomic or nuclear weapons had the moral right to preclude any other state from acquiring them. And he said that, in fact, in doing so, one was destabilizing the international system. Nuclear proliferation, he argued, actually stabilized the system. And so this, of course, results in this mutual terror that you have all states possessing the ability to annihilate each other. It's not a very pleasant state of affairs, but you have to consider the fact that proliferation, some people do see proliferation as a stabilizing factor. And finally, on that score, the issue of whether it can be limited, it's going to be very hard to see how proliferation itself could be, given the fact that alternative energy resources in light of climate change, global warming, for instance, the search for uranium and the mining of uranium and the search for nuclear energy will make it even more pressing and more interesting in the context of proliferation. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Again, Binoy Kampark is now at the University, the RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, formerly the Commonwealth Scholar at the Selwyn College at Cambridge University. James Kitfield is National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the National Journal Magazine. And James, good to have you on our program.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
We want to talk more, of course, about what's going on between the United States and Russia, but there's also a lot going on in Washington with regard to these issues, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty and the START Treaty as well. Tell us, if you will, what the politics are there in terms of trying to control proliferation and in terms of setting a goal of a limitation at a time when the United States military, like other militaries, as we just heard, may want to reconfigure its arsenal according to technological developments.
Well, I mean, I think there is a consensus. I don't think there'll, for instance, be a huge fight over the START Treaty that's being negotiated between Russia and the Obama administration. I think that will pass. I think the Senate will eventually ratify. There'll be some in the sort of right wing of the Republican Party who traditionally, I think the number is often bandied around, there's 18 to 20 senators who just think any arms control treaties are suspect because they can't be verified. But I think that we'll have some support. After that, it gets harder because Obama has said he will put up the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty for ratification again. There is pretty strong opposition led by Senator Kyle to the CTBT, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. It was put up in 99 and defeated by a Republican Senate. So and you need two-thirds votes in the Senate to pass arms control treaties. So they're going to have to get some significant buy-in from Republicans on that. That's a little bit heavier lifting. But, you know, basically the Obama administration has taken the position that proliferation is heading in the wrong direction. There's threatened breakout. The treaties have become weaker and weaker. You have the problem with cheaters of the non-proliferation treaty like North Korea and Iran. You have outliers like India, Pakistan, and Israel. And if you don't do something to reverse the trend lines, then a lot more there'll be nuclear arms races all over the world. And that's going to be a very unstable and dangerous world. And I would take issue with the idea that a rapid spread of nuclear weapons is a stabilizing factor. Maybe that was true during the Cold War when you had two major superpowers who knew that any exchange would mean their utter destruction. But if you have 20 or 30 or 40, 50 nuclear-armed actors out there, some of which have long-standing animosities towards their neighbors, I think that's a very, very unstable world.
What about this argument that no nation with nuclear weapons has the moral right to preclude another nation from having them, whatever the consequences might be?
Well, that is fundamentally the basis and the foundation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which was the nuclear haves who were telling everyone else, you know, don't acquire nuclear weapons, had to show good faith by moving towards disarmament, of getting rid of these weapons. And that held for a good 30 years, and we have much fewer, nuclear weapons powers today versus the 20 or 30 that people thought were going to exist by now when they were looking back from the 1960s point of view. So, I mean, that is sort of the moral bargain at the basis of the Nonproliferation Treaty, which President Obama is trying to reinvigorate, which is by showing that Russia and the U.S. are moving towards smaller and smaller arsenals, you can then get buy-in for stricter measures to make sure that verification measures and all kinds of measures to make sure that the nuclear haves have not remain without nuclear weapons. So there is a moral argument here, but the agreement has been made and it's the foundation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty.
Binoy Kampark, back to you. What about the argument that if nuclear weapons proliferate, then they're likely or possibly will fall into the wrong hands?
Yes, I think, well, it's certainly an argument that has to be taken seriously, and it's one of the consequences of a global system which has fractured somewhat in terms of these technologies. Unfortunately, it again depends on who you define as the wrong sort of people to have these weapons and who are defined as the right people to have these weapons. I think it's important to realize that, again, as always with these things, it depends on who designates who possesses and who doesn't possess these weapons. It's quite right that the Non-Proliferation Treaty was premised on the notion of good faith on the part of those countries with nuclear weapons, that they should move towards a point where they would actually move to smaller arsenals and so forth. But again, this doesn't necessarily get away from the problems we have with a country like Iran, where the issue of the pursuit of a program is probably very much on the cards. The problem and the dilemma still remains there.
Still with us, Ambassador James Collins, former Ambassador James Collins, now with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. What about this issue of deciding who can have them and who can't? Iran argues that if Israel can have nuclear weapons, which the world certainly believes that it does, then Iran ought to be able to have them too, or it's subject to an existential threat.
Well, it seems to me that the ultimate question is not whether you have or have not nuclear weapons, but whether or not having them or not having them is going to make you more secure and your people more secure, if you're at least thinking responsibly about what it is you're trying to do. And the great danger of more and more states acquiring nuclear weapons is precisely that you just have more and more weapons floating around among various players, including at this point the danger that it would fall into the hands of non-sovereign players, and that this is not going to make anybody more secure, including those who may be pursuing them now. So it's not just a moral question, it seems to me, as a trade-off as discussed on the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's also a very practical question of what makes a country more secure. And I think one of the arguments with Iran can easily be to ask themselves whether they will be more secure if within, say, 20 years, if they develop their weaponry or a weaponry capability, you will then have it in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and all around and among the neighbors, whether Iran's people and Iran's government will find themselves in a more secure environment. And I think there's a great question mark to be put after that presumption. So I think, you know, the real point here is what is it that we can do to create greater conditions of security for nations and peoples, and not just focus on the issue of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons played a certain kind of role in the Cold War era. We now live in a world in which that era is past, and we're confronting new challenges. And I think it's in this spirit that I would agree that unless we and the Russians find ways to reduce our weaponry and control and reduce how we approach that issue, it's going to be very difficult to contain any kind of proliferation in any long-term way. However, that is what START is about. And I would make the final point that, after all, we have reduced weapons by thousands, including the delivery vehicles. So the idea that this isn't very significant, I think, is simply not true. The question of whether or not this particular agreement will reduce things sufficiently to have a huge breakthrough, I think, is a question mark. But we certainly will be better off with a framework for reductions and verification between us than if we did not have one.
Let me go back to James Kitfield again, the National Security and Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the National Journal magazine. You said that you thought the treaty now being discussed for renewal by Secretary Clinton and her Russian counterparts probably will be approved again and pass the Senate. When we get to the test ban treaty, though, we're talking about something much more challenging for President Obama, who has now raised this issue. What do you think some of the trade-offs might be if, in fact, it gets as far as Capitol Hill?
Well, I mean, one potential trade-off is a lot of Republicans would like to have something called a renewable replaceable warhead, which is basically to manufacture new pits for warheads. Our own arsenal, we made a decision, unlike Russia and the other nuclear powers, when we stopped testing, to just keep our old arsenal and to monitor it. But it's getting quite old, and some people argue that, you know, these are not new warheads per se. They would just replace an older warhead that we had lost some reliability or some confidence in.
But would you have to test them?
No one's proposing testing. And they think they have a weapons plan, that a blueprint that is reliable enough that wouldn't need testing, and they can do a lot of the things they used to do in testing now in simulations in these supercomputers and laser facilities, et cetera. So that will be one trade-off the Republicans will try to get, and there are, as I said, a certain number who will just never agree to a comprehensive test ban treaty.
What about the bunker busters, which, as I understand it, have some nuclear components, those weapons that are designed to go underground and destroy things that have been effectively buried? Will that be an issue as well?
No, this was, you know, and we haven't really talked about it, but the Bush administration took a whole different views towards arms control and nuclear weapons, and I think it's part of the reason why we're on the wrong glide path, because if the world's, you know, most powerful military needs new nuclear weapons for new purposes, i.e. attacking bunkers, it's very hard to then turn around to argue to other people who have very much weaker conventional forces that they don't need nuclear weapons. So they proposed this, to explore this option of a nuclear bunker buster early in Bush's first term. They realized that there was so much blowback that it was a non-starter, and they kept trying to put in money into the defense budget to explore that, but the Congress said no, and it's a non-starter. There will be no nuclear bunker buster weapon.
Given all of the things, though, that the president is working on now, including health care reform and different ways of regulating Wall Street and all of that, will there be trade-offs involving, do you think, those objectives of the administration?
You know, I said, you know, I think you might have read my piece. It is an issue. I mean, it's not by choice, but by the critical number of issues that were on this president's table, plus, you know, his sort of agenda on health care. There are a lot of things, major policy proposals in the pipeline right now that Congress is going to have to deal with, including the Afghanistan war and a possible surge there, which is going to be very contentious with the Democratic base. You do worry that this kind of agenda, you know, there's only, as one expert told, you know, I quoted in the story, there's only so much bandwidth that Congress has to deal with these major things. And if you push too much into that bandwidth, they tend to get traded off against each other. So, you know, for instance, I suspect, and I don't know this for sure, but I suspect they will hold their powder on the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty till later next year and after the Nonproliferation Treaty Review Conference, for the simple reason they just can't afford to fight all these battles at once. They've got a lot on their agenda, and a lot of these things are very contentious on Capitol Hill.
All right. We started out talking about Hillary Clinton in Moscow, but everything relates, as we so often hear on this program and elsewhere in life. James Kitfield with the National Journal, thanks to you. Binoy Kampark, now in Melbourne, Australia, many thanks to you for being with us as well. Ambassador James Collins, now at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thanks to you. And our earlier guest, Andrei Piontkovsky, a leading researcher at the Institute for Systems Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. The Army and the Marines are stretched thin by the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, and new recruits are almost certain to go to war. But the volunteer military services are meeting their goals and then some. More in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In recent years, a lack of recruits has forced the Army particularly to lower its standards, accepting more high school dropouts, more people overweight, even people with felony records. This year, for the first time since the draft was replaced by the voluntary Army in 1973, recruiting targets are being met in number and in quality. Gordon Lubold reports on the Pentagon for the Christian Science Monitor, and welcome to you.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Pentagon pretty excited about this?
They really are. I got a message over the weekend from one of the officials at the Pentagon kind of alerting me to this announcement they were going to make yesterday. They're just really excited because this is a tough recruiting environment, despite the economy, which helps it, which does counter their efforts. But they're just really excited.
What about the economy? Does it appear that one of the reasons for people, particularly qualified people, going into the military is that they can't find other jobs?
Right. The economy is the foundation for the success, clearly. The military is this, you know, popular draw if you don't have a lot of other options. However, what the Pentagon will tell you is there are other reasons for the success. One of them is that they have spent more money trying to draw recruits in, and the average bonus, I think, is $12,000 or $14,000 for an average soldier to get in. They've made the military a lot more appealing, believe it or not, despite the fact that, for the most part, once you get recruited and finish basic training, you'll probably head off to war.
So that's almost a guarantee, and yet the numbers are up.
The numbers are up, and a couple interesting things that I learned about. They recruit about 300,000 people a year, active and reserve, but they're seeing now for the first time, I think they have a 95% high school graduate rate, which is far higher than the normal rate when you compare the people they've been recruited to America. About 75% of people graduate from high school. Now they're seeing this much higher level of quality. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's important is because, as you pointed out, there was this kind of degradation of the force for some time, and there was a concern that you're creating almost a mini generation of service members who are of poor quality and do have problems in the past. There's the Private Stephen Green, one of the soldiers who was responsible for tragic killings in Iraq in 2006, had a troubled history and was brought into the Army anyway, and they saw the results. Now, with a higher quality force, you try to have fewer of those problems, but you also have less attrition. That's less costly to the Pentagon, and you have just better performers. You've got people who are ambassadors in blue, as they say, for the Marines, you know, representatives of the country who are, you know, representing the country, the U.S. in some village in southern Afghanistan. You want your best and brightest.
There have been reports of violent crime, of drug use, of rape in the military. Is there a hope on the part of the Pentagon that this higher quality recruitment will put an end to that, or at least make it less of a problem?
Right. A lot of it's kind of anecdotal. It's hard for the military to kind of draw these careful, bold-faced lines between cause and effect. But clearly the expectation is that as you have more of your pick of who you want to bring into the military, more high school graduates, more recruits who score better on these aptitude tests, you've got a better force, a stronger force, one that's better equipped to deal with it, kind of these complexities of counterinsurgency and all the rest of it overseas, and that you do have fewer problems. And even though it's hard to kind of sometimes draw this link, that's certainly the expectation. And it really is borne out in the quality of the people that you run into. And I've met myself during various trips across overseas.
We started this program talking about the economy and the two Americas situation seems to be developing and increasing even more and more. What about the officer corps and people from who graduated from college, for example, going into the military from ROTC and the reserves? Are they up too?
Well, they are. Some of the challenges with the officer retention still exist. I mean, you've got people coming in, but you've got a lot of people who are either going to go to college who have to then choose, well, do they want to go to college or go into the military? Either one is kind of a safer bet when you've got a bad economy. I can't tell you exactly what the numbers are for officers, but a lot of the success that he's seen apparently on also true for officers from what I can see.
First President Bush, then President Obama, now President Obama, have wanted to increase the size of the military. Does this give encouragement to that possibility?
Well, it does, because you've got this period now where you have this kind of lagging economy, strong military recruiting. It bolsters the arguments for some people who would say, yes, let's build a bigger military force. As you know, the bigger force you have, the easier it is to kind of wage these long-term labor intensive counterinsurgencies, and we'll hear here in the next few weeks what President Obama does in Afghanistan. But it seems likely, at least the military kind of plans on long-term engagements on some level, and that would suggest a bigger force.
Gordon Leubold, always good to talk with you, and thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks again.
Pentagon correspondent, Christian Science Monitor. Today's program produced by Andrea Brody with Katie Cooper and Christian Bordahl. Our technical director is Wesley Roberts. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.